Hello, it is Tuesday, July 14th. Welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Andrew Jung. Rain clouds left behind by Typhoon Bavi reached Korea Tuesday evening, bringing heavy rain and strong winds. More on that in today's news briefing. In other headlines, the South Korean government has raised the country's growth outlook for this year from 2% to 3%. In our in-depth news analysis segment, we will be talking with two experts regarding the renewed violence in the Strait of Hormuz. Plus, on Hallyu Highlights, we discuss the Emmys and a draft bill that critics say could be a revival of censorship in Korean music. Korea 24 starts now. Rain clouds left behind by Typhoon Bavi reached the Korean Peninsula on Tuesday evening, bringing heavy rain and strong winds. With torrential rain forecast, especially in central areas, people should prepare for storm-related damage. For more on this and other major headlines of the day, we have in the studio with us Deputy Editor-in-Chief of KBS World's English News Service, Kim In-young. Hello, In-young.
Hello, Andrew.
Typhoon Bavi has weakened into a tropical depression, but rain clouds associated with the storm have reached the Korean Peninsula. What kind of wind and rain intensity are we looking at overnight?
According to the Korea Meteorological Administration, rainfall will peak between Tuesday evening and early Wednesday with up to 50 millimeters of rain per hour forecast in northern Gyeonggi province and western parts of Gangwon province. Seoul and other central regions as well as North Jeolla province could see up to 30 millimeters per hour. Through Wednesday, northern Gyeonggi province could receive more than 120 millimeters of rain, western parts of Gangwon province over 100 millimeters, and Seoul and other parts of the capital region between 30 and 100 millimeters. The mountainous areas of Jeju will see winds exceeding 25 meters per second. For the rest of the country, gusts are expected to reach around 20 meters per second. The rain and wind will ease Wednesday afternoon.
Aside from the intense winds, what specific safety hazards should the public be bracing for tonight? And what happens once the storm system moves out?
Well, authorities warn the public to secure signs and other flimsy structures to prevent them from flying away. With heavy rain expected to fall at night, people should also prepare for potential damage from landslides, flooding and structural collapses. The weather agency warned that although the heat wave will temporarily weaken during the storm, high humidity after the rain could push perceived temperatures back up.
In economic news, the government has raised the country's growth outlook for this year from 2% to 3%. What's driving this optimism?
The Ministry of Finance and Economy said Tuesday that the adjustment reflects an unprecedented artificial intelligence-driven boom in semiconductor shipments. The nominal growth rate, which doesn't account for inflation, is projected to reach a 30-year high of 12.3%. Building on this momentum, the government aims to raise the nation's potential growth rate to 3% by 2030 from its current level of less than 2%. To achieve this goal, the ministry said it'll accelerate its three recently announced mega projects, which include semiconductors and AI, and designate new initiatives related to rechargeable batteries and sensors. But the job market remains bleak, especially for young people. The government expects job growth of 150,000 this year, about 40,000 fewer than last year due to the Middle East conflict and the sluggish construction sector. To mitigate the impact, the government plans to create 200,000 new jobs, including public sector positions tailored for young people.
So we're seeing a bit of a mixed signal here. The government has raised this year's GDP growth outlook to 3%, but job growth is slowing down. With this broader economic momentum in mind, how does President Lee Jae-myung intend to leverage strong semiconductor exports to push growth?
During a cabinet meeting on Tuesday, Lee said the government should accelerate economic transformation in the second half of the year and make 2026 the beginning of a push to raise South Korea's potential growth rate to 3%. He outlined the government's longer-term economic goals and said the nation should aim to become one of the world's top four trading nations and increase its per capita gross national income to $50,000. To make this happen, he called for a gradual increase in the potential growth rates by stabilizing inflation in the housing market and fostering new growth engines. He also urged central leadership, regional authorities, and businesses to work together to accelerate the three mega projects and emphasize the need for reforms in the public sector and labor market.
Finally, after several days of strikes, U.S. President Donald Trump says his military will serve as, quote, the guardian of the Strait of Hormuz and charge a fee for ships transiting the waterway in exchange for their security. What are the latest details on the shipping charge and how is Iran responding?
Trump suggested in a Truth Social post that the U.S. would be paid to guard ships in the Strait of Hormuz at a rate equivalent to 20% of the cargo's value. Speaking to reporters in the Oval Office on Monday, Trump also said that the U.S. military was striking Iranian military assets that threatened shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. Let's take a listen to what he said.
And we're hitting them very hard, and it'll continue, and we'll see what happens. But we're knocking out all of their offensive capability. And we're controlling the straits. We're putting the blockade back. And it's a blockade not for anybody but Iran. In other words, anybody doing business with Iran can't go through. Everyone else will be able to go through. So it's a blockade. It's a very strong blockade. The blockade was probably more effective even than hitting them. But I think the combination is the thing that really does it.
But do you think a deal is still possible? You think they'll return to that?
Yeah, I think a deal is possible. Sure, I do.
The U.S. military has carried out three consecutive nights of airstrikes against Iran. Washington deployed sea drones in combat for the first time in its Sunday strike, which targeted Iran's submarine and ship maintenance facilities. Amid the escalating tensions, the United Arab Emirates said Tuesday that Iranian cruise missiles had struck two Emirati commercial oil tankers in the southern lane of the Strait of Hormuz, killing one crew member and injuring eight others. The Iranian military says it will not allow the U.S. to interfere with its management of the Strait of Hormuz.
We'll be talking more about this in our in-depth news analysis segment, but that was it for today's news briefing. Thank you, Ingyo.
Thank you, Andrew.
Truth is, I am Iron Man.
Hongdong, Korea, this is Bob Layton, co-creator of Iron Man. You are listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
President Donald Trump on Monday said the U.S. would serve as the guardian of the Strait of Hormuz and be reimbursed at a 20% rate on all cargo shipped through the crucial waterway. His comments came after the U.S. and Iran exchanged fire over the weekend, threatening a return to all-out war despite having reached an interim peace agreement in June. In a further escalation of rhetoric, Trump went on to declare that he planned to strike Iran, quote, very hard. Iran, however, has maintained that it controls the Strait of Hormuz and early on Sunday said the waterway was closed until further notice. For expert analysis of the renewed tensions and the prospect of full-scale hostilities, we are joined on the line by two guests. First, we have Dr. Siavash Safari, a political scientist from the Seoul National University who is an expert on modern Middle East politics. Hello, Dr. Safari.
Hi, Andrew. It's good to be with you and KBS World Radio listeners.
Thank you for joining us. We also have Vandana Hari, founder and CEO of Vanda Insights, which provides global oil markets macro analysis. Hello, Ms. Hari.
Hi, Andrew. Great to be with you and join Professor Safari as well.
Hello to you, too. The U.S. and Iran are halfway through a 60-day interim peace agreement, a 14-point memorandum of understanding that was intended to pave the way for negotiations on a permanent end to the war. Instead, the situation has deteriorated into a series of clashes over control of the Strait of Hormuz. Professor Safari, what's your take on the latest developments in the Strait, and why do you think the interim deal is unraveling, and what could be the strategic calculations of the U.S. and Iran?
Well, Andrew, in the last few days, for anyone who's been following the news, we've seen that Donald Trump has repeated several times that the MOU is finished, that it's over. The Iranian side hasn't officially declared the MOU to be over, but they have announced that as far as they're concerned, the Strait of Hormuz is closed, which means that Iran, too, is no longer bound by the MOU. Now, to understand what's going on, we should kind of step back a little bit. We should remember that before the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, which began in February of this year, the Strait of Hormuz was fully open. The U.S. and Israel's excuse for attacking Iran was the nuclear issue, with this, you know, unsubstantiated claim that Iran was building a nuclear bomb. That issue now seems to be mostly forgotten, and the main sticking point has become the Strait of Hormuz. Now, the reason that Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz after the U.S.-Israel attack is quite simple. If you look at Iran's conventional military capacity, you'll see that Iran is really no match for the United States. The U.S. is a global superpower with nuclear weapons, while Iran is a country that's been under an arms embargo for the better part of the last 47 years, which is why Iran has pursued this sort of military strategy of asymmetrical warfare, using drones, using missiles, building a network of regional allies. And then in the course of this war, Iran realized that by closing the Strait of Hormuz, it can apply enormous economic pressure on the U.S. and world economy. And it seemed to have worked at some point, right? When we look at the MOU terms were quite favorable to Iran, including in the MOU, if you look at it, the U.S. agreed that Iran would have the ability to manage commercial passage from the Strait of Hormuz. But what happened since the MOU was that the U.S. has tried to undermine Iran's control over the Strait of Hormuz. And in particular, the U.S. has put pressure on Oman, the other country with territorial waters where the Strait of Hormuz is located. U.S. has put pressure on Oman to open an alternative route for the passage of ships. And from Iran's perspective, this is a violation of the MOU. And so we saw that Iran began to strike ships that were taking the Omani route. And in retaliation, the U.S. has launched a series of strikes inside Iran.
Ms. Hari, could we also get your take on the latest developments? Do you agree with Dr. Safari's assessment?
I think the professor has given quite a good recount of the geopolitical circumstances surrounding where we find us today. Let me shed some light on the market perspective. So as we speak today, Tuesday afternoon, Asia time, 14th of July, Brent futures, which is sort of the benchmark crude prices that are tracked globally, have jumped back above $85 a barrel. That's the level we last saw in crude futures before the U.S.-Iran Memorandum of Understanding that was signed on June 17th. So essentially, the quite substantial drop that we saw in crude prices after the MOU was signed, and as the market became quite optimistic that the Strait of Hormuz will begin reopening, all of that drop has been reversed. So what that tells you is basically the market is now in complete uncertainty as to whether the Strait of Hormuz will begin reopening, at what time, when that might happen, at what pace that might happen. Essentially, right now, there is so much noise, so much geopolitical rhetoric and noise in the market. It's really hard to discern or to have any sort of a trajectory or plan for what sort of supply we should see from the Persian Gulf. So in other words, the market participants are really in the dark here. I think one another important point to make is still we are not really seeing prices reflect the full extent of the supply shock that the market could be in for if this continues on a prolonged basis, because, you know, we would at least need to see prices back in triple digit territory, perhaps going up to 150 or beyond, way more than what happened in the 3.5 months of the war. And why that's the case, we can talk about separately. But suffice to say for now that I think a part of the calculations for the market still is that there will be some road found back to diplomacy by these two countries. But how, when, where, all of that remains to be seen.
The details are always evasive, I guess. And you mentioned triple-digit prices for oil. And as tensions over the international waterway ramp up, the United Arab Emirates accused Iran of a, quote, brazen attack on two tankers in the Strait of Hormuz on Monday. That incident left one person dead and eight more wounded. Ms. Hari, could you walk us through the current state of the Strait of Hormuz?
Yeah, so what matters most for the market, of course, there's all the rhetoric and the narrative wars going on. What matters for the market is exactly the state of the transit in the Strait of Hormuz. So the best numbers that we saw were just a few days after the MOU was signed. The number of daily transits on one particular day went up to as high as 70. That's the highest number we've seen since the start of the war on the 28th of Feb. That was still way below the 130 or so daily transits of all kinds of ships. And this is not just oil and gas tankers that we used to see before the war. As things stand today, and with the caveat that it has become very difficult, even for the most dedicated and disciplined of ship tracking agencies, to exactly count the numbers, because more and more ships have again started going dark, turning the transponders off. With that caveat, I think one can safely take the number as less than a handful. So it has dropped quite sharply from that 70 number that we saw post-MOU peak to maybe three or four per day. So as far as the oil markets are concerned, for all practical purposes, the Hormuz is shut again. I don't think we can rely on any amount of oil reliably and sustainably coming out of it again until US and Iran are able to get back to the negotiating table and resolve this whole tussle over the control of the strait.
Ms. Hari, you also mentioned just a little bit ago that details were still missing, especially on how or when it plans, the Trump administration, that is, plans to implement the proposed cargo fees for ship transiting the straits. However, the U.S. Central Command announced that its blockade of Iranian ports will resume at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Tuesday. How realistic is Trump's proposal regarding, that is, the 20% fee on all cargo ships going through the waterway? And how do you think that could be enforced in the strait?
Yeah, so Trump's declaration yesterday has really caught the international community off guard. It's very hard to take that at face value, not in the least because since the start of this war, the U.S., Trump himself and senior administration officials have consistently and firmly taken the view that the strait should not be under any particular country's or party's control, that it should be free. There should be freedom of navigation in the strait exactly as it was before the war began. So this is a complete 180 degree turn on the part of Trump, and almost implausible, I would say, because this is it's the part about U.S. Running, quote unquote, he said, we may practically run the strait and charge 20% of cargo, which, by the way, is a horrendously high fees. 20% of all cargo shipped, Trump says, would be a fair reimbursement, again, his word, for the U.S. Maintaining order and security in the strait. But even if we were to, like, let's set that aside for a second. Is it even possible for the U.S. to restore shipping in the Strait of Hormuz on its own or even in partnership with any other countries as long as Iran doesn't want that? That's the big question. If it was possible at all, you know, the big question is, why didn't the U.S. do that through all the weeks of the war? I mean, a lot of people would argue a big part of the urgency on the part of Trump administration to signed this MOU to bring the war to an end was to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. You know, if they were capable of doing it, if the U.S. was capable of doing it on its own, it would have done it by now. So personally, I'm very, very skeptical that the U.S. has the ability, or at least to be able to do that in a reasonable time frame, let's say the next several months, because what they'll need to do is not just degrade Iran's military capabilities, but neutralize in a way that Iran can never, or for the foreseeable future, pose a threat to traffic. That's the only way I can see that the U.S. can ensure that the traffic resumes to, you know, goes back to normal. So at this point, you know, it's really very, very hard to see that happening.
Mm. So if, and that is a very big if, the U.S. is able to levy those charges based on current oil prices and exchange rates, a tanker carrying 2 million barrels of crude could expect to pay as much as 50 billion won, or roughly 33.5 million U.S. dollars. Again, if the Trump administration was able to implement his 20% levy. We go back to Dr. Safari. Trump said on Monday in a radio interview that the deal between the U.S. and Iran struck last month to reopen the strait and to open negotiations about Tehran's nuclear program was, quote, merely a test. He also declared his intent to strike Iran. Professor Safari, how do you think the situation will pan out? And do you think there is still room for the two sides to resume peace talks?
Well, you know, Andrew, when the MOU was signed on June 17th, there was quite a bit of enthusiasm around it. A lot of people thought this might go. This was going to end the conflict. I've always maintained a skeptical position about the MOU. I think I was on your program shortly before the MOU was signed, and I expressed this sort of skepticism. The reason for my skepticism is because I think for the United States, the ultimate strategic objective of this war was to impose U.S. control, U.S. dominance, U.S. hegemony in the Middle East and in the Persian Gulf region, and to force Iran to capitulate, to surrender. We even heard Trump and Netanyahu talk about regime change in Iran. And so the point is, as long as the U.S. pursues this goal, and as long as Iran challenges U.S. hegemony in the Middle East, we're going to see continued tension between the two countries. And so from this perspective, the MOU was never meant to end the war. The U.S. was never intended to follow the MOU in a strict way. In fact, just earlier this month, a few weeks ago, we heard U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance saying that the U.S. government was using the MOU as a temporary measure to stabilize, you know, energy markets and to rebuild depleted petroleum reserves. Obviously, these are statements that the Iranian leaders are also following. And so this erodes the trust that Iran has in the process of building any sort of agreement with the U.S. And as I explained earlier, from the moment that the MOU was signed, the Trump administration began to undermine it in several ways. One issue was the Strait of Hormuz, but the other issue is the war in Lebanon. We remember that the very first point out of the 14 points in the MOU was to end the war on all fronts, including in Lebanon. But ever since the MOU was signed, we've seen a continuation of war in Lebanon, where Israel, with full support from the U.S., occupies the southern part of the country, kills civilians, destroys life-sustaining infrastructure, attacks UN peacekeeping forces. And so all of this suggests to me that the conflict is going to continue for the foreseeable future. And unfortunately, I should add, we are seeing also signs that things might escalate much further in the coming months.
And because of this very complex set of circumstances, South Korea has been looking to diversify its supply because, again, it imports about 70% of its crude oil from the Middle East. And so this country has been trying to look for other sources of crude oil. Shipments of non-Middle Eastern crude have also expanded due in part to oil reserve swaps, mainly from the U.S. In light of the situation in the Strait of Hormuz, Ms. Hari, can East Asian countries and South Korea mitigate supply disruptions by diversifying crude oil import sources?
So it's going to be really tough because, as I mentioned, all in overall, IEA member countries had pledged to release about 400 million barrels, though that included contributions by Japan and South Korea. The lion's share of that oil was coming from the U.S. And as a result, the U.S. is already, when you look at the strategic petroleum reserve in the U.S., has dropped to a 43-year low. U.S. commercial oil inventories are now sitting at four-year low levels, which is not a good situation for that country to be in. So to what extent U.S. can continue bailing out the rest of the world with increased exports, more release of stockpiles, I would say is a huge question mark over there. So when we say that, okay, Asia can look towards U.S. or, you know, North America or even South America, I would say there is only a marginal difference that strategy can make now. If Hormuz remains closed for a long time. And then people talk about, well, finally, there is the demand response. So demand response, unfortunately, will have to come. Prices will have to go up high enough for consumers just to tighten their belts. But, you know, that's the kind of managing of a supply shock that you do not want to wish on the global economy. Because in that sort of scenario, we are looking at very high inflation, perhaps central banks having to raise interest rates quite a bit again. Ultimately, when economies contract, you know, it hits everybody. It hits people like you and me. And the recovery can be quite difficult and a long road out of it. So basically, it's just looking increasingly scary situation, maybe even a sort of a panic. And the supply shock would hit us really strongly this time around if we are entering another long, prolonged phase of closure of Strait of Hormuz.
I think we can say with certainty that the uncertainty is very fraught and is expected to continue for the time being. But that was Dr. Siavash Safari from Seoul National University. And we also had Ms. Vandana Hari, the CEO of Vanda Insights. Thank you both for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 49.90 points, or 0.73%, on Tuesday to close at 6,856.83. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ lost 15.38 points, or 1.92%, to close at 783.98. You can check Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next, we are joined by Daniel Che for our Korea Trending segment. For this part of the show, we check out some of the most viewed stories and issues covered by Korean news outlets handpicked by the Korea 24 team. Hello, Daniel.
Hello there, Andrew.
What's our first story today?
Shake Shack, a global hamburger franchise, has been giving out World Cup merchandise with what could barely pass as a Korean national flag due to various design flaws.
What was the issue with the Korean flags handed out by Shake Shack?
Well, the central Taeguk symbol was depicted as a simple red and blue circle split in half. Curves and color arrangement differ from the authentic flag, and other core components of the Taeguk-gi, the four trigrams, Kon, Gun, Gam, and Ri, were all missing. So there's only a red and blue circle at the center of a white background. At a glance, it looks like a Japanese flag with a blue blemish at the core.
Obviously not the way many here might want the Taeguk-gi to be represented. How were the errors discovered?
It became widely known after Professor Seok Young-duk of Seongshin Women's University posted about the issue on social media on Tuesday. He found out about the fake Taeguk-gi after being informed by Koreans residing in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, that customers at the burger chains there receive a souvenir shaped like a foam hand with a pointed finger featuring the flags of 48 countries qualified for the World Cup when they purchase a World Cup set menu.
And how did Professor He respond to the incident?
He said such a move undermines the meaning or the spirit of the World Cup and added that it is unacceptable for a world-renowned business to make such a mistake with a national symbol like the flag, and that such a global firm must accurately understand the basic information about the countries in which it does business in. Professor He vowed to ensure the distribution of this merchandise is halted by sending an official protest email to the headquarters of the burger chain.
Hoping the error can be fixed soon, but let's now move on to our next story. What do you have, Dan?
There's been increased sightings of tropical and subtropical species in the southern resort island of Jeju here in South Korea, namely blue swimmer crabs.
I'm suspecting global warming is a reason, but how much of an increase is this?
It's become so frequent with more and more people, including residents and tourists alike, posting on social media their encounters with the blue swimmer crabs, a growing number of first-hand witnesses by local residents and tourists. So that's a major change from before, when you only see photos and videos of such rare subtropical marine life captured by professional divers.
So what was once considered very rare is now occurring routinely. What are some of the main causes?
So these are species found mostly in countries with subtropical waters like Taiwan, Philippines, and Australia. Jeju's waters are already believed to be approaching the threshold for subtropical seas, which is seeing annual average sea temperatures reaching 20 degrees Celsius or higher. The evidence of Jeju's warming seas has been confirmed through multiple studies. The National Institute of Fisheries Science said the surface temperature of waters around Korea increased more than twice the global average rise of 0.76 degrees Celsius over some 6 decades. The Subtropical Fisheries Research Center pointed out Jeju waters is warming at an accelerating pace.
Global warming is something we're going to have to live with, at least for the foreseeable future, something I do not enjoy saying. But what does the National Institute of Fisheries Science plan on doing from now on?
Well, like you mentioned, we have to roll with the punches and learn to live with it for now. The Institute plans to monitor and study changes in the marine ecosystem caused by the appearance of species such as blue swimmer crabs. They already launched a study into their route of entry, changes in distribution, and it is a concerning development for local fisheries sector as the spike in such species occur while there's decline in local species such as yellowtail and various squids being noticed. Officials plan to review how the species can be developed into a new ocean's resource, potentially, be it in the food sector or tourism. Already, some parts of Jeju are bustling with locals and tourists eager to take pictures of the blue crabs or catch them and share related information such as where best to catch them, the best fishing method, as well as cooking ideas on social media.
Other than the fun that we just talked about, hoping we can cool the earth on a more serious note within a generation. But now to our final story. What do you have, Dan?
A gigantic cylindrical CT or computed tomography device is installed at the National Museum of Korea to better investigate Korea's cultural heritage.
And what's the significance of this device?
Well, according to the National Museum of Korea, this is the world's largest cylindrical CT device. The new scanner can accommodate objects up to 1.1 meters in diameter and 3 meters long. The X-ray ring rotates around the stationary artifact in a 220-degree arc on rails parallel to its length. It can non-invasively inspect and map the internal structures of large objects like statues and other artifacts. The specialized CT scanner can also create highly detailed 3D models.
Other than being huge, what makes it different from other CT scanners? Any particular standout advantages?
Well, the National Museum has been using CT equipment to study artifacts since 2017, so they are familiar with the technology. But this particular massive machine is different, as it can accurately photograph large objects that were difficult to investigate with previous equipment. A 600-kilowatt conventional CT scanner would hold the object in place while the X-ray source only moves up and down. But the new scanner leaves the object still while the machine rotates and moves all around it. So it can scan large, heavy, and delicate objects better than conventional scanners and more easily and quickly.
Did the museum specify the exact scope of the machine's usage moving forward?
Yes, they did. They plan to use it to conduct more detailed investigations and turn it to better study a wider range of objects, from small ancient ornaments to large wooden statues and fragile unearthed items. It is also looked to help accurately date wooden artifacts, as the new scanner would be able to read the growth rings of traditional wooden furniture and other timber objects without having to cut them for samples. The National Museum plans to build 3D survey data for Korean artifacts and expand its study into different fields.
And that's all we have for today's edition of Korea Trending. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm pianist Kevin Chen, and you are now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
Welcome to this week's edition of Hallyu Highlights, your weekly scoop on everything hot in Korean entertainment, from the latest K-pop hits to the K-dramas everyone's binging. And again, we are joined in the studio by our resident K-culture expert, Bernie Cho. Bernie, nice to see you again.
Always good to be back in the studio. My goodness, when you call me resident expert, you make it sound like I actually kind of sort of live here, which I don't.
You do, okay. A little bit. I would disagree with that. But we start today's Hallyu Highlights with some welcome news. This is something we briefly touched on in our Korea Trending segment last week. But this is worth diving deeper into. Veteran Korean actress extraordinaire Yoon Yeo-jung is looking to add to her historical Academy Award trophy with a potential Emmy Award statue, as she has been nominated for her role in the hit Netflix series Beef Season 2. This is obviously significant, but how much of a big deal is this, and how many other awards has Beef 2 been nominated for?
Wow, it's a lot to unpack here, but let's remember, again, similar to like K-pop Demon Hunters, Beef and Season 1 and Season 2 is also a runaway hit on Netflix. And we should remind the listeners out there that Beef Season 1 was a critically acclaimed award season darling. Picked up a bunch of trophies for a lot of the participants in Season 1. Now, the cast has changed, although the writer, creator, showrunner is still the same. And this time around, Beef Season 2 has 16 nominations across the board. And again, some of these are amongst the biggest categories. Now, Season 2 is interesting because it's got some big names. For instance, Song Kang-ho is in Season 2, and he's awesome in it. Obviously, Yoon Yeo-jung is fantastic. She plays one of the main characters, Chairwoman Park, who is the billionaire chair of a country club. But this particular series, Beef Season 2, which many believe is one of, if not the best series out there right now, it is up for Outstanding Limited Anthology or Series, Outstanding Lead Actor, Outstanding Lead Actress, Outstanding Supporting Actor, and of course, Yoon Yeo-jung is up for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Limited or Anthology Series or Movie. That is a mouthful. But, you know, look, getting the Academy Award, I mean, that is a career-defining moment. But to add to her trophy case, potentially, the possibility of a Primetime Emmy Award is really next level. And right now, the only other artist out there that is kind of sort of going for the legendary, almost mythical EGOT, the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony, is the ladies over at Huntrix, K-Pop Demon Hunters, because they picked up an Academy Award and a Grammy. But nonetheless, there is a very good chance that Yoon Yeo-jung could get half of the EGOT. And, you know, already she is considered one of the greatest of all time, which I believe the kids call GOAT. But nonetheless, truly impressive. And again, we shouldn't just be rooting for her, but for many of the others who are also up for awards. I know for me, one of the highlights is actually one of the breakthrough actors in this particular series, Charles Melton. Is also up for an award, and he's been getting a whole lot of love in this particular series. And one actor that we don't give enough credit for, and I'm kind of sort of wondering whether this was part of the breakup plan, but one of the members of CARD is also in the series, playing basically a beefcake at the tennis club. But nonetheless, it's a fun series, a fantastic series, and it's awesome to see that season two is as good, but some people may even argue, no debate here, that it might be even better, season two. But again, 16 nominations is really remarkable. And the fact that the creator is also of Korean descent, Korea, I think, is going to be very well represented at the upcoming Emmy Awards.
Well, good luck to Yoon Yeo-jung and the rest of the folks at Beef Season 2. But for our second item today, we're going to be talking a little about politics. It sounds boring, but more specifically, we're going to be talking about a few controversies swirling in the K-pop music industry. Bubbling up to the top of today's trending topics is a new amendment to the Music Industry Promotion Act. Forgive this boring wording, but we're going to have to kind of go over this. Forwarded by Representative Kim Hyun and nine other lawmakers belonging to the governing Democratic Party of Korea, which calls for music distributors to pre-screen any and all new music tracks for any and all content that might be deemed harmful to minors under the age of 19. So, needless to say, this is going to be triggering, and this has triggered, an uproar in the Korean music industry, with a coalition of 11 cultural and art groups voicing their opposition to what they see as a repackaged revival of censorship. This is obviously a head-scratcher from where we stand, but for listeners who might not be as familiar, Bernie, tell us why this new attempt to pre-screen new music is very controversial and what prompted this proposal. And finally, will it work or backfire?
Well, for full disclosure, my real day job, it's not this, by the way, is actually I am a music distributor. And this popped up on my radar because this is a hot topic among many people in the music industry. Politics aside, regardless of which party you belong to or which side you happen to be on, every few years, this topic pops up, and every few years, the industry is usually up in arms about anything that remotely sounds like, smells like, feels like censorship. Unfortunately, this time around, it sounds like, smells like, feels like censorship, but there's a little bit of a twist to it, so hence the reason why people think it is quote-unquote new. Now, the root cause and the root problem has to do, obviously, with bullying and violence, and just a lot of, it just seems to be there's a rise in bad behavior, particularly with things like violence and worse hate speech among the youth. Huh. Now, unfortunately, and again, this is not a uniquely Korean thing, but globally, for whatever reason, politicians like to point the finger at music as somehow being the source and the impetus of all these social ills and social evils, which newsflash, not the case. And one of the things that's a bit understandable, but nonetheless concerning, and hence this is one of the reasons why we're talking about it, is right now there's a lot of screening for new music, but often when it comes to lyrics and when it comes to things that might not be suitable for minors, it's usually determined after the music's been released. And usually it's with radio and TV broadcasters that if they feel that the lyrics are in whatever reason inappropriate, those songs after release are screened and then banned. Personally, I think that is effective. Mm. Now, the burden is no longer post-release, but pre-release. And the burden is no longer on, say, the broadcasters who have every right and reason to make sure that music, whether it's seen or whether it's heard, is safe for the general public. The fact is now this burden is put onto distributors, companies like mine, who are now being asked to pre-screen. And what has a little bit of teeth to it is that if for some reason a song is judged harmful and the creator is under the age of 19, distributors are supposed to block the release altogether. Hmm. Truth be told, when we get new music, and we get a lot every day, we do not have the bandwidth or time to listen to every song and study every lyric. And then to find out whether or not an artist or whoever submitted it is under the age of 19 is really hard to determine. Now, for those who happen to be artists that are an adult, we're supposed to, as distributors, make it very loud and very clear that this particular song has elements that are supposedly harmful to the youth. Now, what has a lot of people in the industry up in arms is, who determines what's harmful for the youth? Where do you draw the line? Because it's a very slippery slope. It's not a black and white issue. If anything, it's 50 shades of gray. And then on top of that, once it's designated as being harmful, supposedly the industry now has to find ways to restrict that music's access to the general public, only to adults. That is logistically and from a technology standpoint impossible.
So it sounds like they're shifting the burden of enforcement onto private distributors, which is going to create a new set of problems. And then this might be a debate for a different time, a different day, but there's also the problem of, if you ban something, it suddenly kind of looks more attractive, if you know what I mean, right?
You know what? We're going to touch on it today. We're going to tackle it today. This is not a debate. This is a fact. The moment you tell kids you're not supposed to listen to this, you're not supposed to watch this, guess what? That is the best marketing and promotional banner, sticker, endorsement you could have. And so, look, I understand the good intentions behind these lawmakers wanting to kind of create this new safety net. I get where they're coming from. But to blame societal ills on music lyrics, I think, is a little misguided. And this has been proven time and time again, not just locally, regionally, but globally.
And historically.
Historically, correct. And then on top of that, this will have the exact opposite effect of what they're trying to enforce. And so, and again, for good reason, many associations, many groups in the industry, not just music, but the cultural arts industry, have put forward their stance, their opinion on this particular issue. And so we will have to wait and see. But again, Korea, South Korea has had a long history, unfortunately, of governments and politicians using music and restricting music as a form of censorship. And for a lot of people, it's triggering that this kind of sort of looks like censorship. Now, again, we cannot take away and more importantly discount the good intentions behind this. But I believe very strongly this will have the exact opposite effect of what they're intending. So I think that tackling, you know, protecting the youth, I think, is a good thing and the right thing. But this might not be the approach, I think, because it's literally going to have the exact opposite effect. And I think what we'll do is, instead of making the situation in some way, shape, or form better, it may actually make the situation worse.
So your view is you endorse the intent and the goal, not the method, though.
Yeah. And again, the societal ills are very real. But to oversimplify the problem and the solution, music, I think, is, and this is my personal opinion, a bit naive.
We're going to be talking more about the law, but a different part of the law.
Not law yet. It's just the bill.
Right, right. We're going to be talking about what is actually a law, not a draft law, actually, in this next segment, because we're going to be talking about three lawsuits, one of which we also touched on last week briefly on Korea Trending. The lawsuits in the U.S. target three of the biggest K-pop hits in recent memory. Everyone knows this. I think even my mom will know this. NewJeans ETA, NewJeans House Suite, and BTS Swim. Over the past 3 weeks, these three very high-profile lawsuits against HYBE and their subsidiaries, partners, and collaborators have seized headlines for alleged copyright infringement claims from songwriters who have filed claims that allege that their demos somehow made it into these hit songs. What has been the response? Do these claims have merit? And what are the issues and implications, Bernie?
Well, specifically to NewJeans, unfortunately, this is not the first time that their hit songs, which have gone on to have hundreds of millions of streams, have been accused of plagiarism. For instance, the songs Bubblegum and How Sweet and now ETA have all been accused of plagiarism. Now, some of these copyright infringement and plagiarism cases are currently unfolding in the U.S. courts. Now, initially for some of these songs, there was a very defensive posture in the sense that deny, deny, deny. Can't happen, wouldn't happen, shouldn't happen, didn't happen. However, with the latest filing specific to ETA, Adore has taken a little bit more of a conservative stance where it's no longer just a straight up denial. It's we're looking into it, which I think is the right response, because there is an inherent risk when these big K-pop stars are leaning into numerous songwriters. And look, the artist had no idea. I think the executive producer likely didn't have an idea. But the law of averages, when you have a few to even a dozen or more songwriters involved, it only takes one songwriter to break ranks and cheat, to take it down and ruin it for everybody. And so essentially, when we look at the lawsuits, these particular aggrieved songwriters are throwing everybody and the kitchen sink into the filings. And so it's not just the companies, it's individual producers and songwriters who are in some way, shape, or form part of the creative process. They've all been thrown in there with the idea that something might stick. Now, what's really intriguing about these particular lawsuits is the fact that there's no longer instantaneous denial. There is basically a deep dive, in-house look as is there merit. And the fact that the days of immediate denials are over, the fact it's being taken seriously, I think, sends a really strong signal. And again, I don't think it was intentional if it occurred, but this is an inherent risk when you work with multiple songwriters. The other case that just came up, which I find and many people in the industry find incredibly intriguing, is the latest copyright infringement lawsuit against not BTS, but HYBE and all the people who worked on the smash hit single Swim. What makes this particular lawsuit intriguing is the fact that there was a timestamp. There was receipts. There is clear evidence that when these particular songwriters submitted their demo for consideration, they used a very popular technology platform called Disco. It has nothing to do with the music genre. It happens to be a service that a lot of industry people use for sharing music files for consideration, whether it's for new songs or whether it's for soundtracks. It's something that, you know, we look at, we use, a lot of people use. And in this particular lawsuit, there is proof that not only did they submit their song for consideration on Disco, they actually have a timestamp on who among that songwriting team actually listened to the song. And so this was has a lot of people in the industry intrigued, because this is the first time where there's actually digital footprint proof.
So like a smoking gun almost.
Well, smoking gun might be a little strong, but this is the first time where the guesswork is not there, because it's there's proof that somebody in the inner circle of that songwriting team for Swim had access and had listened to the song. And so this has a lot of people in the industry intrigued. And again, for this particular technology platform, now everybody knows what it is, because it's a great software platform. But the point is, there is a timestamp, and this has a lot of people intrigued.
Those were some interesting and very serious stories. A bit of a change for our segment, How You Highlights. But that's it for today's How You Highlights. As always, thank you, Bernie.
Always good to be here.
And that's also a wrap for today's edition of Korea 24. But we'll be back tomorrow. Again, you can always listen to Korea 24 on various apps, KBS Kong, KBS World Radio, and KBS World Radio on air at 7:10 p.m. Korea Standard Time every weekday. I've been your host, Andrew Jung. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio strives to promptly update our listeners on safety procedures during emergency situations. The following are recommended guidelines to follow in case of heavy rain. Before the rain hits, make sure your windows are sealed and check for any clogs in water drains nearby. During heavy rain, try to stay indoors and monitor the situation through your local news. If you are outdoors, stay clear of dangerous places such as lowlands, basements, and worn-down buildings. Do not approach streetlights, traffic lights, or utility poles, as there is a possibility of electrocution. If you're driving, slow down to 60 to 80% of your normal speed and maintain a longer distance between cars in your lane. After the rain stops, ensure that your tap water has not been contaminated and is safe to use. If your house has been flooded, make sure all the gas and electricity is off before entering and call an expert for a safety investigation. You can call your local government for repairs of sewages and roads. Please check our website at world.kbs.co.kr for up-to-date information and procedures.
KBS World Radio.